I think it's appropriate to dedicate our learning, God willing, to an end to the war and to the safety of all the innocents. And yes, our minds are very much especially on the Jewish community in the Ukraine. I wanted to just note two things before we launch in. First of all, a correction to something I said last time. We were talking about the origins of foods that we associate with the Jewish world, and I mentioned deli as not really being Jewish originally, but being Ukrainian. So I looked further back at the original articles that I had read where it said that, and basically I think it's broader than that. I think it's Eastern European on the whole. Also worth noting, the word delicatessen itself is German. So everybody gets in on the act. That's number one. Number two, and more relevant going forward, the next series, the one after this one, and I don't remember anymore what date it's going to start, except that if today is March 2nd, it will probably be starting March 23rd. We have this week, then we have March 9th, then a gap week. The next series will be March 23rd, I believe. And that series will be about Pesach, about Passover. It'll be a three-parter on customs, on English Haggadot that are now available for people to use, a few different things. And it will be presented by Rabbi Jared Anstandig. Rabbi Anstandig is a member of my Beit Midrash. He's new this year. He's fantastic. I'm going to send out his bio and his video and so on. It'll be a free series. Since you don't know him yet, I want to make sure that that people have a chance to meet him. I think you'll really enjoy him. So that'll be starting March 23rd, and it'll be a three-parter preparing for Passover. But back where we are, the foods of Shabbat and Yom Tov and holidays. Last time round, we introduced, first of all, some of the philosophy involved in the meals of Shabbat, and specifically the idea of oneg, the idea of pleasure. One is supposed to enjoy the Shabbat meal. And as we said in our first weeks of the series, the idea here is, again, that eating becomes a religious experience. It is a connection to God. I'm putting the link in the chat again for the source sheet. It is a connection to God. It is something that is ethical rather than simply the animal instinct. So we then moved into talking about particular foods. And we talked about challah. So that was last week. And I hope you saw the follow-up links that I sent out in the email last week after class about separating challah and the mitzvah. And then we moved into kiddush. And we talked about wine and elevating our pleasure as part of connecting to God. In the end of the class last time, I noted Judaism is really concerned about wine and alcohol, such that I might have expected that we would say, forget it, just use grape juice. Don't forget wine. I mean, grape juice as a commercial commodity is relatively new. Anybody know when they started producing grape juice commercially? Late 19th century is the beginning of commercially available grape juice. The reason for that is because what grape juice is really just the juice out of the grape, and it's going to go bad. It's got a lot of sugar in it. You haven't allowed it to ferment. You halt the fermentation process early, and it's going to go bad. Well, there are two reasons for it. Number one, how do you halt fermentation? What do you do? You pasteurize it, right? You heat it. That's what happens. You kill the bacteria in it by heating it. And that's why it doesn't ferment. So pasteurization requires that there be a Louis Pasteur. Right? You actually have to develop that scientific understanding that explains why fermentation is taking place and how to halt it. So that's number one. And number two, you need the means of preserving it. So commercially available grape juice is only a thing starting in the latter half of the 19th century. But in terms of its use for kiddush, we do generally say that it's acceptable. There are those who argue it's not ideal because the wine that was used in the temple on the altar was a wine with alcoholic content to it. It was not a heated wine, so it may not be considered the best of the best. On the other hand, if you're telling me there are hazards in promoting alcohol, then maybe you should say, let's just have everybody use grape juice. But I think there are four factors that explain why we don't just say, let's prohibit wine. Number one, when you're dealing with wine, it is possible to calculate a safe dose if you're talking about people who are not vulnerable to addiction. In other words, we're not talking about somebody who has an alcohol issue. We're not talking about a minor. You're talking about an adult who has, you know, a normal health pattern and is able to stop and so on, does not have any demonstrated problems. So you can, you know, if you know a person's body weight and you know what they're eating, you can figure out what's safe to drink. That's number one. Number two, we said last time, wine is a part of many mitzvot in Jewish life. That shows that it has the power to consecrate. We're not willing to just write it off, because it does have this history with our mitzvot. Number three, and this is an important distinction between wine and recreational marijuana and drugs in general, people drink wine often for the taste as opposed to for the buzz. There's an idea of this wine tastes good with this particular food. There's only one reason for a person to use drugs. Right, as I like to say in classes where I've discussed recreational marijuana use, no one smokes marijuana for the smell. It's all about the high. With wine, it isn't necessarily about that. If it is about that, if someone is drinking the wine for the sake of the high, then I would say no. Use grape juice for your mitzvah. I think that's not what the mitzvah is supposed to be. And then finally, Judaism recognizes value in feeling better, even if we don't want to go too far, right? We mentioned last time the verse, which I brought again on the sheet in source number one, and wine which gladdens the heart of man, making faces shine more than oil does. That's the verse from Psalms on which Rabbi David Kimchi commented, I brought it there in source number one, drinking it in measure, it will improve his intellect. For a joyous heart improves the intellect as seen in the prophets. He says, you become smarter. You become sharper. Now, you may think you become sharper. I don't know if everybody around you agrees. There's a certain sense that loosening the inhibitions in a person may help them to express themselves better. I don't know, hard to say about the intellect part of it. But there's certainly a sense that it can have a positive impact and that it can be good for a person. So for all of those reasons, you don't find wine written off. At the same time, where there's any concern whatsoever for a health issue, choose grape juice. It's simple, it's straightforward. And it should always be available, certainly, I said last week, if you have guests at your table, don't put them in the position of needing to ask for grape juice. You know, make it available and they'll choose as they do. And of course, actually, I should have said this last week also, I'll say it now. If you know you're inviting somebody who has an issue, don't put out alcohol at all. You use grape juice also. It's kind of obvious. I feel silly even saying so, but nonetheless, I said it. Okay. That's in terms of that issue, just wrapping up the wine discussion from last time. Comments or questions on that before we move into some other foods? Okay. Then let's go into some other foods. Fish. If you take a look at source number two, this is not gefilte fish that you're going to see described here. This is breaded fish. In the Talmud, Rav Chiya bar Ashi said, quoting Rav, even a small dish prepared for Shabbat fulfills the mitzvah of creating Shabbat enjoyment. You don't have to have 10 different foods. He says, even having something special counts. What dish? So what is he saying, like when he says even a small dish? Rav Papa said, a cup of small fish fried with their own oil and with flour, right? It's breaded fried fish, no? That's what he's talking about. The Aramaic term for it is kasa daharsana. Just for those who are curious about the chronology on this, Rav, who talks about having even a small dish, is in the early 3rd century, Common Era, living in Israel. And then Rav Papa is a later generation. Rav is about 100 years later with his cup of small fish. There's a classic story in the Talmud, you may have heard this at some point, involving a person known in the Aramaic as Yosef Mokir Shavi, or Mokir Shabbos. In the English, it translates to Yosef who honored Shabbat. Take a look at source number 3. Yosef who honored Shabbat lived in a neighborhood along with a wealthy non-Jew. Astrologers told the wealthy man that Yosef was going to end up with all of his assets. Right? We've talked about astrology. We had our series where we talked about that. We said we're not supposed to rely on astrology. Nonetheless, astrologers tell this fellow that Yosef is going to end up with all of his assets. The man sold off his assets and bought a gem with them and placed it in his turban. He says, I'm going to make sure that I keep my assets under lock and key. Now, all of it is wrapped up in this one gem. Better than investing in Russian rubles, I guess. Well, when the man was crossing a bridge, a wind blew his turban into the sea, where it was swallowed by a fish. The fish was caught and brought to market on a Friday afternoon. The fisherman asked, who will buy fish now? It's already Friday afternoon. Now we're going to start selling this. People told them, go bring it to Yosef, who honors Shabbat, for he regularly purchases. He'll be very happy to buy this great fish that you have. No one knows there's a gem in it. They brought it to Yosef and he purchased it. He cut it open and found the gem inside and sold it for 13 roomfuls of gold. In general, when you see the number 13 in a context like this in the Talmud, it just means a very large number. It doesn't mean literally 13 roomfuls of gold. But the point is that he does very well because he honored Shabbat. And an elder met Yosef and declared, one who lends to Shabbat will be repaid by Shabbat. But the example of how he spends for Shabbat is fish. I see Diane's note in the chat about her grandmother in Montreal who always had cold fried fish for lunch on Shabbat. Was the cold part because it was Montreal, or was that just, you know, happens to be so? Don't know.
It was cold.
Okay.
Made it on Friday.
Got it. So this is a basic food, as the sages used to observe Shabbat, going back, you know, to Talmudic times. One more example of this, source number 4. Rabbi Akiva said, make your Shabbat like a weekday rather than need the aid of people. If you have to choose between seeking financial help and you know, going without for Shabbos, he says, so then go without. Don't start, you know, taking a handout. However, one should still do something small in his home. What is that? And again, Rav Papa chimes in, just like he did in source number 2, a cup of small fish. What's with the fish? Like, why such an emphasis? What would you say is the reason for having such an emphasis on fish?
Maybe meat was too expensive, and the Pale of Settlement, not everybody could afford meat or chicken.
So they
could fish for the wrong fish.
Right, so keep in mind, they're not in the Pale of Settlement, right?
Oh,
these are people who are living in Israel, and some of the sages we're talking about in Babylon. Yeah.
They live, I guess they live near bodies of water where fish
yes.
was available, and they could, it was fresh, and it was inexpensive.
Right. Fish was available. It's the Mediterranean diet. Exactly right. That's why they're able to have it. Mark, you were going to say? I'm coming back to the meat. I'm coming back to meat. Sorry?
That's good luck.
Good luck? Fish for good luck.
There's no ayin
hara. Ah, so we're getting to that. Mark goes beyond the issue of what's available in the supermarket with his suggestion. And indeed, if you take a look at source number 5, Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein, who did not have the Mediterranean diet available to him, he was a rabbi in Novardok, the end of the 19th century, early 20th century Lithuania. And no bodies of, I mean, they had bodies of water, but the fish was not as available to them. Nonetheless, he says, today there are also those who are careful to have fish in every Shabbat meal. This has a hidden reason. He's referencing some kind of mystical idea. What is the mystical idea? So, a number of sources talk about the fact that if you go back to the story of creation, fish are blessed that they should become many, pru urvu, to bear fruit and to multiply on day 5 of creation. Human beings are blessed with bearing fruit and multiplying on day 6 of creation. And then day 7 is Shabbat, which has its own blessing. So, the idea is you are uniting 3 blessings. The blessing of day 5, the blessing of day 6, and the blessing of day 7. That's one idea. Another idea is that fish are not destroyed in the flood. Right? God floods the world, but the fish are doing just fine. So, that's a second approach. Not all the Midrashim agree that the fish are doing fine, nonetheless. And then the third, a third idea is the one that Mark mentioned, which is we have the idea that fish are safe from what you could loosely call the evil eye. We had classes a few years ago, which we talked about the supernatural and we talked about the evil eye, and we established that the root of that idea is about jealousy. In other words, the core idea of an evil eye is somebody looking at somebody else and saying, why do they have what I don't have? And appealing to God and saying, where is the justice in that? And we're taught in the Talmud, if you appeal to God like that, God's going to judge you first for what you have. But nonetheless, it's a serious concept that you want to stay away from arousing people's jealousy. Well, the fish is concealed in the water. No one can see it. So it's an expressing this idea of being concealed from sight. That's another idea. Historically, there was a challenge regarding this fish practice. Because everybody knew, Jews and non-Jews, that Jews eat fish on Fridays. It's very funny when you think about it, because right, Jews aren't the only ones who are known for that. But the Jews would always have fish as a Friday food, as a food for Shabbos. They would buy it on Friday in order to eat it for Shabbos.
It wasn't the main dish.
It was not the main dish necessarily. That's correct. We're going to come back to that. But it was certainly a food that the Jews were buying, and the result was price gouging. Right? Like matzah before Pesach, right? So the prices go way, way up. So fish went way, way up from time to time. Whether it was being sold by Jewish merchants or non-Jewish merchants is not clear, but it's in the literature. And what happened was, the sages said, okay, we're going to ban the use of fish on Shabbat in order to drive down the price. So I brought you one source on it, Rabbi Avram Gambiner, in source number 6, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, he says, if the non-Jews elevate the price of fish, it is appropriate to enact that people should not purchase fish. And he was quoting something that preceded him, the Tzemach Tzedek, Rav Krachmal, also, he was in 17th century Moravia, Rabbi Gambiner, 17th century Poland. But that was the practice. And that goes all the way back to a concept in Talmudic times of the rabbis saying, if merchants take advantage of a ritual, then the answer is to change what we're doing within reason for the ritual. Meaning there are certain rituals you can't do in another way. Certain things just can't be done in a different way. So I don't have an option of saying, for example, if matzah becomes expensive, let's use burger buns, right? That's not okay. On the other hand, fish is a nice thing to have. It has all this symbolism to it, and it has centuries and centuries of tradition behind it. But if people are going to go broke trying to have it for their Shabbos table, then we have a problem. So so there's precedent for doing this. And the precedent literally goes back to the Talmud itself, where the rabbis did this when bird merchants raised the price of birds that people needed for their sacrifices. And so they said, okay, well, we're going to follow a certain ruling regarding bird offerings such that you don't need to bring as many. It's a longer story. I'm not going into that whole discussion right now. But the idea was to say, we don't really need the fish. We can get by without the fish. And this way, people will be better off. One last note on the fish, and then I'll take comments and questions. Professor Michael Steinlauf did research on what he called the gefilte fish line. The gefilte fish line goes north-south through Eastern Europe. In areas east of the line, which today includes Lithuania, Belarus, Latvia, Estonia, gefilte fish had to be savory. You couldn't have sugar in your gefilte fish. Also true in other dishes, aside from desserts. They didn't like sugar in their food. Whereas west of the line, it was sweet gefilte fish.
Oh,
yeah. So you had people on the east side of it having savory gefilte fish, and people west of it having sweet gefilte fish. We're going to talk more about that line. It's going to come up in a little bit with another food. Okay. Any comments or questions regarding the fish discussion? Marilyn. Well, we also have that with animals, that we have rules about which ones. So I don't see why the
fish...
Very
specific in fish as well, scales and so on.
Yeah, so with the animals, it's split hooves and chews its cud. I wouldn't necessarily see that as different. It's an interesting thought, but I wouldn't see it as different. Although, it is, I should point out, it's a lot easier to have kosher fish than to have kosher meat, in the sense that all you need is the right species. Whereas with animals, you have to worry about shtita. And what if the animal turns out to have a mortal wound? You shech the animal, and then it turns out that it had some kind of an injury separate from that, and now it's not kosher. So I think that is another reason, potentially, why you would look at fish as a safe option. So I think that is a good point. Soup. Let's talk soup. We talked about chicken soup in the beginning of the class last time. The grandmother's chicken soup recipe, and the doctors who are recommending it, and the Tashbates whose doctor recommended it in the 14th century. And all of those are important, but it's also considered important to have hot food for Shabbat. Diane, I apologize to your grandmother. But it's important to have, it doesn't mean all the food has to be hot. But to have...
It was just like an appetizer, so
got it. Okay. But there's an idea of having hot food, and the reason why we value having hot food is because hot food is a challenge on Shabbat. Let me explain. And we're going to talk about cholent in a little bit, and this is relevant for cholent as well. You know that we don't light a fire on Shabbat. You also know that we don't cook on Shabbat. So because of that restriction, it becomes very hard to actually have hot food. However, the rabbis have explained that there are ways to heat up food on Shabbat. So if I have a blech, right, if I have a tray that's covering my burner on the stove, if I have a hot plate that's on, then I'm able to take certain kinds of food and warm them up on the tray, on the blech, on Shabbat. Not all kinds of food. I didn't intend for this session to be an intricate discussion of which kinds of food and how and all of that. But my point is that historically, you would have some people who said, you know what? I want to be strict in my observance. I don't want to trust the rabbis with their leniencies and all of that. I'm just going to have cold food on Shabbat, then I don't need to worry about it at all. And that was viewed not as a good thing by mainstream Jewish practice, it was considered a terrible thing. If you take a look at source number 7, Rabbi Zrachya Halevi, who I believe is 13th century, says, some say the sages required that one enjoy Shabbat with hot food. Specifically, you have to have hot food. And one who does not eat hot food should be investigated for heresy. How do you like that? this person is rejecting the tradition of our grandmothers about how to have hot food on Shabbat. So therefore they said, make sure you have something hot. Now, again, I'm not discussing the ins and outs now of how to do it and what Jewish law accepts and all of that. We could have a series on that at some point if people are interested. But but having chicken soup was a way to have that hot food. And then there's kugel. Oh, Eti, yes.
When you say Shabbat, are you talking about Friday night or are you talking about Shabbat during the day?
So soup was usually a Friday night thing, because there would be a challenge with warming up a liquid on Shabbat during the day within the laws of Shabbat. So it's usually Friday night. There are soups one can make with, you know, in a crock pot today that will actually stay good even if they're put in before Shabbos and they're good until Shabbos lunch. But I defer to those who are better with both food safety and cuisine, than I am. Because I know that it's tricky to find a good soup that you can actually leave in a crock pot that long.
Okay, I have a friend who lived in a senior's residence that was kosher, and there was the mashgiach there with the black hat, etc. And I would go visit her after by synagogue on Shabbat. It was on my way home. And usually you would be at lunchtime after synagogue, and they always had potato salad and cold cuts for lunch.
Interesting. I don't know what to tell you, except that it may have been easier for the diets of the people there in the facility. But I really don't know anything about, you know, why would have done it. I can conjecture, but it has, I don't know. I don't know why they would do it that way. We do value having hot food, but again, I don't know what their resources were. Let's talk kugel. So kugel comes from a root in German meaning a ball or a globe. Probably because the old style kugels were round and puffed up. Kugel is a very old food in Jewish sources. It's not one of these recent Eastern European imports. The Talmud in source number 8 references something called muliata, and Rashi, commenting on it, explains what muliata was. Rashi himself is writing in 11th century France, but he's describing a food that they would have been having 800 years before that. And he says, this is a food, I'm just hearing stuff in the background, I'm going to mute people by default. Okay. This is a food stuffed with meat. As we stuff lamb and chickens between the meat and the bones. So Rashi says we, in 11th century France, will stuff lamb, will stuff chickens, but they had a food that they used to stuff with meat. It was dough that was filled with meat and baked in the oven. That was this muliata, and that is the earliest type of kugel I can find in our literature. In the Middle Ages, it gains the name paladin, or Israelis will know, pashtida. Pashtida is still used today as a word for a kugel. And if you take a look at source number 9, this is from a student of Rashi, writing, again, late 11th century, early 12th century in France, saying cake or pashtida or palon, I don't know what palon is, must be placed in a hot location close to dark before Shabbat. And this is talking about baking it, and the concern that he's expressing is don't bake it on Shabbat. It has to start its baking already before Shabbat. There must be enough time that the upper and lower face of the dough will form a crust and the filling will reach minimal edibility before Shabbat. The word kugel for this only shows up, hang on one second, Betty, only shows up at the end of the 18th century. That's where you first see this word, but they're still having dough filled with meat. That was what they called kugel. Last note, and then I'll take questions on kugel. The gefilte fish line also affects kugel in terms of pronunciation. If you're west of the gefilte fish line, you call it kegel. If you're east of the gefilte fish line, then you call it kugel. The Litvaks versus the Galicianers. Okay, Betty, what were you going to say?
That, to me, sounds more like a beepknish than it does like a kugel. On what, I've never seen a kugel. I've never made a kugel that had meat stuff. It just, I don't get the
At some point, it became more popular for people to make, as you say, kugels that are all carbohydrates. There's the Yerushalmi kugel, the Jerusalem kugel, there's the potato kugel, there's noodle, you know, all different kinds. But I see Vanessa wrote it in the chat also, is this a kugel or a knish? They were, at the end of the 18th century, they were using the word kugel to describe this stuffed one. So, cuisines change. The cultures we lived in changed. You're right. You know, today, people would think of this as a knish. You know, for those of you who read my weekly email, about a month and a half ago, I sent out an email about borekis and knish. And they're really the same thing, they're just in different cultures. But each one is adamant, no, this is what it is. It's a borekis, no, it's a knish, and so on. Okay. Other comments or questions about the kugel before we move into one more key food, which is cholent. Okay, let's talk cholent. So, cholent in Ashkenazi lands, or hamin in Sephardi lands. So, we have a rule, which we've already referenced, which is that we're not allowed to put food on a flame on Shabbat to cook. Right? If it's a solid food and it's already been cooked before, that's a different story. But I'm not allowed to put uncooked food on a fire on Shabbat. So if I want hot food, I basically need to put it up before Shabbat. And again, there are things you can, but I'm not, that's the basic rule. So therefore, they would put up cholent, which takes forever to cook. You can just keep on going, hour after hour after hour, and that's just fine. And so it would contain beans, potatoes, beef. That was your classic cholent. Yes, it is true, there is such a thing as a vegetarian cholent. My family frequently has it because I have multiple vegetarians in the family. But if you ask people, okay, but what's cholent? You know that if you're having a power of cholent, the vegetarian cholent, you need to say that. The default assumption that people have when you say we're serving cholent is that it's going to have the meat in it. The names themselves are interesting. The name chamin means what?
Warmed up.
Warmed up. That which is hot, right? From the word cham. Originally, it meant hot water. So, for example, in source number 10, I brought you a Mishnah. You're now going back 2,000 years, in which they talk about how the laws of Shabbat kick in. First, some of the laws kick in as you get close to sunset, a period called Bein HaShemashot, close to nightfall. And then, when it actually goes dark, then the laws are in place fully. And one of the things that it says you're allowed to do as it's darkening, but it hasn't quite darkened yet, it isn't quite nightfall, is to wrap chamin in a way to insulate them in a way that will preserve their heat. And there it's referring to hot water. What about cholent? Where does the word cholent come from? So I brought you source number 11 from, once again, the source of all truth, Wikipedia. It sounds really good. I'll just say it sounds like they know what they're talking about. Max Weinreich, I don't know who that is, but you can probably click on him to find out, traces the etymology of cholent to the Latin present participle calentem, meaning that which is hot, as in calorie, via Old French chalant, present participle of, chalt, from the verb chaloir, to warm. So that's one etymology, is that it means hot, right? I'm thinking of caliente, right? It's something that is hot. One widely quoted folk etymology derives the word from French short, hot, and Lent, slow. I'm probably mispronouncing that, right? I'm betraying the fact that I did not grow up in Canada. I was not forced
long,
to learn French. Long. Okay.
Long.
Long. So, hot and slow. Another folk etymology derives it from Hebrew. This is very funny, but it's totally not right. The she-lan, which means that which rested, as in resting overnight. This refers to the old-time cooking tradition of Jewish families placing their individual pots of cholent into the town baker's ovens that always stayed hot and slow-cooked the food overnight. That was a thing. There's a lot of rabbinic literature on this issue of leaving your cholent in the baker's oven because of the problems that come up if people can't tell whose is whose or if something leaked and like all sorts of stuff happens involving these cholents left in the baker's oven. But that's another hallmark of Shabbat. Now, last time, Mark asked me about meat as an obligation for a Shabbat meal. If you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, also known as Rambam, says this: one must prepare an especially fatty cooked food and a spiced drink for Shabbat. I apologize to the doctors, but this is considered something enjoyable. Each person should do this in accordance with his funds. A person who expands in expenditures for Shabbat and in acquiring good and plentiful foods is praised. A person who doesn't have the financial ability and only makes a stew or something similar for the honor of Shabbat qualifies as fulfilling Shabbat enjoyment. He says it doesn't have to be any particular food. That's not a requirement. You want something really nice. And Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, who we quoted before, says the following in source number 13. Maimonides believed that this list is non-specific. If a person were not to like fish, what could he do? Right? You're going to force me to eat fish and call that enjoyment? Essentially, one should prepare a cooked food which he likes. It should be especially fatty, as that is the manner of the wealthy. So have rich foods. Again, if it's a health risk, please don't do this. You're not safeguarded by the fact that it's Shabbos. The Talmud used the example of what was normal in their times because those types of foods were beloved to them. That's why you see it there. These foods are per se required. When you're dealing with holidays, there's a greater reason to argue that there's a need for meat specifically because the holidays involved a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And in that pilgrimage, one was supposed to bring a special celebration korban, celebration offering. And that offering was meat, and we commemorate that. So there's more of an argument to be made for meat. But certainly for Shabbat, there's no requirement if somebody doesn't like it or if it just becomes so expensive that it's not something you can afford. So have something else. That's what we say. The bottom line out of all of this is that the food of Shabbat is about having a great meal, but it's also about elevating mundane existence by, again, creating a connection to God in the pleasure of the day and building that relationship that began in the Garden of Eden when God said, eat this and don't eat that. It's an extension of that original concept. Clear? Okay. Any other Shabbos foods that I missed? Don't think I missed any. I think we got it. The only thing I didn't mention is the practice of having something to drink between the fish and the meat. Right? You familiar with that? So there's a line in the Talmud that talks about not cooking fish and meat together. There was a health hazard that they were concerned about. I actually have a friend who's a physicist in Israel who claimed that it had to do with the breakdown of the omega-3 acids in the fish, or I don't really know. He had an explanation for why that would actually be a concern. So they said, we're going to be so careful that we'll make sure that we're going to have one food, and then we'll eat something in between to clean out our mouths. You have some bread, and then you have a drink. It doesn't need to be whiskey. You have a drink in between in order to, again, clean out the mouth, and then you proceed with the other kinds of food. That's where that comes from. Sorry, someone was going to say, I didn't hear who it was. Okay. All right, let's move on to the next topic then. We got kashrut, kosher food, as our next topic.